The Guardian.
Is the internet broken? Has the utopian optimism of the 90s given way to a new era of digital feudalism, where just a few powerful entities wield control over all of us digital serfs? And are people right to describe this as a form of surveillance capitalism, a new kind of slavery where our digital selves are owned by the tech giants?
We haven't relinquished control. It's been grabbed from us. It's not just about the things that we say on Facebook or the things that we say in other social media. What's being taken from us is the stuff below the waterline. They know our locations. They know our moods. They know our thoughts. And they have all this data below that. And that's what they're grabbing. They're not asking us for this.
I'm Jordan Erica Weber, and in this series, we'll be looking at internet-enabled dystopia and how even technology designed to do good can end up causing harm. We'll look at the effects on democracy and trust and what steps we need to take to wrest back control. But this first show explores the extent to which our privacy has been compromised by the tech giants whose services we rely on every day.
400 million users. Facebook is developing tools that collects users' interests in products and then shares that information on other websites.
When I was a young teen, one of my favorite books was a young adult dystopian novel by M.T. Anderson called Feed. Set in a near-futuristic America in which the majority of citizens are constantly connected to a futuristic version of the internet called FeedNet via brain implants called Feeds. The story is told from the perspective of a teenage boy called Titus who has grown up with this technology.
I don't know when they first had Feeds, like maybe 50 or 100 years ago. Before that, they had to use their hands and their eyes. Computers were all outside the body. They carried them around outside of them in their hands. Like if you carried your lungs in a briefcase and opened it to breathe.
Titus and his friends rely on their feeds. They use them to talk to each other, to look up information, to find their way around, to entertain themselves, and, importantly, to buy things. They are subjected to constant advertising as the corporations that control the feeds monitor their moods and movements and market products to them accordingly. Maybe it's not such a far-fetched future.
Surveillance capitalism is the feedback loop between surveillance, which is the accrual of information, and capitalism, which is about the accrual of wealth. So what happens when you have this feedback loop?
That's Aral Balkan, a man who describes himself as a cyborg rights activist. More on that later.
Where existing wealth sponsors systems that gather intimate insight about all of us, which in turn lead to even more wealth for the same small group of people. That's surveillance capitalism. It's a term coined by Shoshana Zuboff from Harvard Business School to explain essentially the socio-techno-economical system that we live in today.
As he describes it, our present is not so different from the future laid out in Feed. A lot of us spend a lot of time on platforms that we rely on, which in turn gather information about us that is used to make money from us.
People farming is a term that I use to describe the business model of companies like Google and Facebook. These platform monopolies have two audiences in their business model. They have their users and they have their customers. And the way it works is they track and store and analyze everything about their users to create profiles of them. And these profiles, they monetize with their customers. So what they're really doing is they're farming people, their users, and they're monetizing them with their customers. This is, of course, a very extractive and exploitative system.
Amazing, because I have this love-hate relationship with Facebook because I constantly feel like my information is just going everywhere. What is going on with this new thing?
According to Balkan, we think we're the users of platforms like Facebook and Google, but we're not. He draws a distinction between a company like Apple, which sells us products, and companies like Google, which make us the products, farming us for our data that can be used to make money. We rely on Google, and in order to use its services, we relinquish control of our personal data.
We haven't relinquished control. It's been grabbed from us.
That's Gus Hussain, the executive director of a UK charity called Privacy International. And he wants to make sure that we don't undersell this situation.
What's interesting about the current market environment is that it's not capitalism. It's very powerful entities who are just becoming more and more powerful. Capitalism never envisioned five companies running the entire planet. And yet that's what we have. And when a company becomes rich enough, it actually stops innovating and just buys other companies. And in this case, just to gather more and more data. I would like to see capitalism return, where it's about giving people choice, about enticing people and involving people and engaging people and showing real value. We don't know the real value we are to Facebook, other than the fact that Facebook just makes hand over fist in money, but we're not necessarily seeing the return on that. So I wouldn't mind being able to see and participate in an economy that I am an active, autonomous individual participant.
Balkan says that we have an oligarchy. Definition? A government in which a small group exercises control, especially for corrupt and selfish purposes.
Google is pressing ahead with the introduction of a new privacy policy, despite warnings from the EU that it might break its data protection laws.
Companies like Google may not officially be part of the political administration, but they do wield a lot of power.
If you look at the statistics that Oxfam has gathered, we live today in a world where five men have as much wealth as half of the world's poorest population combined. That's 3.5 billion people. And these five men are not just any five men. We're talking about Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Ellison, and Michael Bloomberg. So all of these men are intimately intertwined with this system of surveillance capitalism that we were talking about. This is problematic because this is not a democracy. This is not a democratic system. This is a feudal system that we're talking about, where a tiny group of individuals knows everything about everyone. Thereby, there is this huge power imbalance that exists. Now, this is really problematic state of affairs if we care about things like certain freedoms and certain human rights, like privacy, because, wow, we have a handful of people that know everything about everyone. It's problematic if we care about democracy, because if we know that all of our communication is under surveillance, then that has chilling effects for democracy.
We are indeed in this era of digital feudalism where you have to seek refuge and protection from very powerful bodies with the hope that everything will be okay. And just to put that into a relatively recent case, people are going to roll their eyes when I use this example, but there was a huge controversy just over a year and a half ago about Hillary Clinton running her own mail server. How dare she run a mail server? Because that was impossible to be kept secure from hackers, whether it's the Chinese or the Russians or others who might want to hack. The 1990s view of the internet was that everybody could run their own services. We would be in control over our data. We'd be in control over our own services. But with the migration towards just us using these large entities, what Hillary Clinton did wrong is that she didn't seek refuge in Gmail. She didn't seek Google's protection from the Chinese, Google's protection from the Russians, because she decided to go it alone. And the lack of investment and innovation in technologies that actually empower the individual with the security threats, we're reliant on the king of Google to protect us and hopefully protect us from the Chinese, the Russians, and maybe the hacker next door.
Balkan says that the problem with these powerful companies like Google and Facebook is that we want to treat their platforms like public spaces, places where we can hang out with our friends and chat about whatever we want, without worrying about any repercussions that might come from anyone listening in. And these platforms don't actually work like that, though the companies that run them benefit from us acting as if they do.
companies like Google and Facebook want us to think that they are parks, that they are public spaces, but they're actually shopping malls. They're private property. And on someone's private property in a shopping mall, you don't have a right to free speech. You don't have a right to privacy. The only rights you have are what the owner of that shopping mall grants you. And so this is why having a total lack of public space in the digital realm is detrimental to democracy, because what in essence has happened is we've lost all of our public space. We don't have a public sphere anymore. We have private space that masquerades as public space. And this is the problem that's at the heart of many of the symptoms that we're seeing. You know, symptoms like, why is there fake news? Why is there bullying and all of this hate on these platforms? And why aren't the platforms doing better to censor? All of these questions go away if we were to have a decentralized system.
There's this wonderful New York Times photo of people commuting in New York on one of the commuter trains in the 1920s. And it shows all these, they're all men, of course, heading to work dressed like madmen. And they're all reading the paper, and they're all being antisocial, and essentially being private in a public space. You look at the modern equivalent of that, we all have our headphones on. We all have our own e-readers. We all are exhibiting the exact same thing that we've always exhibited. Where the change has occurred is essentially below the waterline, the things that we're not seeing, the fact that the modern equivalent of reading the New York Times on the train is reading, say, the Guardian on your phone, and the Guardian getting all that data, and then advertisers getting all that data. That's what's changed, and we don't even know that. We don't even encounter that. We don't see it. We can't control it. And similarly, in the home, whereas previously we would be speaking amongst ourselves in the home or speaking to neighbors via the telephone or some other form, everything is intermediated by Facebook. So all of a sudden, a conversation between two people, like say two kids who go to the same school down the street, is now being sent via California and monitored via California so they can find out the best way to advertise to these kids.
Now, as anyone who follows me on Twitter will know, I love to shop, and sometimes a Facebook advert from a retailer I've shopped at before will prompt me to buy a new dress. I've even found myself wishing more than once that these retailers knew more about me, so that they would stop showing me great dresses that aren't available in my size. So what's the problem with these companies collecting our data if it just lets them show us things they know we'll like? Why should we be worried? Well, maybe because the inventor of the World Wide Web is.
So one of the issues with social networking silos is that they have the data and I don't. Certainly, there are, people have gone around and demanded their data. So Google has, in fact, you can have your data back policy. So I think that there will be consumer pressure on companies to provide that data.
That was Sir Tim Berners-Lee speaking about the potential misuses of personal information back in 2012. But in March this year, as the World Wide Web turned 28, he published an open letter in which he wrote that he has become increasingly worried about three new trends, the first of which is that we've lost control of our personal data.
We haven't relinquished control. It's been grabbed from us.
Berners-Lee is also concerned about fake news and political advertising, which we're going to talk about in another episode in this series. But even before you get to the government level, companies are doing more with our data than just using it to sell us clothes, as Gus Hussain explains.
About a year ago, Admiral Car Insurance came up with a product that said, young people have a hard time getting discounts on insurance, car insurance. If you give us access to your Facebook profile, we will offer you discounts. What's interesting about the access to the Facebook profile, it wasn't about seeing who your friends were and trying to judge you based on your friends. They wanted to judge you based on your grammar. So things that you couldn't alter, things that just part of your behavior, they wanted to judge you on that. So if you and I made plans for tonight and I said to you, let's meet up tonight, and you responded, yes, let's meet up at 8 p.m., I would have to pay more for my car insurance than you would, because you are much more specific and much more thoughtful, and I'm not. But that's just based on a conversation of throwaway comments. But this is already this idea that, first of all, you can be observed in your natural habitat like an animal, and then judged by an entity as to whether or not you should have access to something at a better price or not. So that's already happening. What's also happening is what we call social media intelligence, which is whether it is an intelligence agency or just your local council, and of course the police in between, they're all monitoring Facebook. They're all monitoring Instagram, Twitter, and they're monitoring in real time to make decisions about people. And so while you think you're interacting with your friends, and while you may understand that the Facebooks of the world are also monitoring you in order to provide access to advertisers, you're also being monitored by the police, the local council, somebody you're protesting against. These people are constantly monitoring you and judging you and treating you differently accordingly. We are already being scored. We are already being monitored, and we have no idea what's going on, but we are being rewarded for good behavior. Then there's beneath the waterline, all the data that's being accumulated about your interactions that you can't control. So Facebook knows what time you wake up every morning. Facebook also knows everybody you've communicated with, but also Facebook knows everywhere you've been. Unless you've gone through the effort of saying, do not share location data. But even then, Facebook knows all of this, whether you like it or not. And that data is also being processed and made accessible to others.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll look at whether we really can own our own data and on the steps we need to wrest back control.
I want to be able to take a camcorder, walk into your corporate office. I want to be able to look at all of your paperwork, including your financials, all of your algorithms. I want to be able to see all of your source code. Let's do that as a beginning, and then we can start talking about symmetry, because right now there is an exponential power differential.
The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Welcome back to Chips with Everything. I'm Jordan Erica Weber. We've been hearing Aral Balkan and Gus Hussain talking about owning our data, but that concept might not be as simple as it seems. Maybe you're one of those people who brushes these kinds of concerns aside with an, I've got nothing to hide. Maybe you believe that you personally could never be at a disadvantage because of what data a company has access to, that you're immune to manipulation and that you've never said or done anything that might encourage a company or official to treat you worse than anyone else. Well, Balkan thinks the problem is bigger than any one person's individual concerns. Remember when we described him as a cyborg rights activist? That's because he believes that human beings in the digital age extend beyond their biological boundaries, and that these digital extensions of ourselves should fall under the protection of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
When we talk about privacy in the digital age, what we're really talking about is whether or not we continue to safeguard the integrity of personhood. And this relates back to what data really is, data about people. Because if I have enough data about you, and if I have the algorithms by which I can try to start to simulate you, that is what I end up with, a proxy of you, a digital copy of you. It's very important at this point, who owns and controls that digital copy of you? Is it a corporation? In which case, this is a violation of the integrity of yourself, of personhood, or is it you, yourself?
And Gus Hussain agrees.
Your data should always belong to you. It is not something that you sell to another, because if it becomes property, then it becomes ownable by others and they can do as they see fit. The fundamentals of privacy as a right is that no matter where your data is, you retain rights. But going deeper into it, the fact that all that data is out there and could be seen as an extension of yourself, I think that's an optimistic view. The more worrying view is that all the data that's out there is more important to the powerful bodies of the world than you are as a human being.
There's a sense in which companies care more about the profile of you that they've built from your data than the real human you, especially as they get better at using those profiles to predict your behavior.
So how much worse can this situation become? Well, again, let's look at Facebook. Facebook right now, at their last developer conference, they announced that they have 60 people working on reading your mind, literally reading your mind, so that you don't have to make any effort to express what you think because they will already know it.
I don't know when they first had feeds, like maybe 50 or 100 years ago. Before that, they had to use their hands and their eyes. Computers were all outside the body. They carried them around outside of them in their hands. Like if you carried your lungs in a briefcase and opened it to breathe.
The idea is that they want to share your personal information, not just within Facebook, but outside to all the websites that might have alliances with Facebook.
And then it's very important that we safeguard our fundamental freedoms, because in the direction that we're heading, if we don't, what we're heading towards is a new slavery. In slavery 1.0, we owned people's bodies and everything else, of course, that made them who they are. Now what we're heading towards is slavery 2.0, where, of course, it's no longer legal to own people's bodies in many places. What is legal, however, is for me to own everything else about you that makes you who you are, apart from your biological body. That is the digital copy that I'm talking about. So it's very important that we own our own digital copies, that we own the simulations of ourselves, which we call today profiles. Because if we don't, then we are going to be slaves to those who do.
For this series, we also spoke to Kevin Kelly, the founding executive editor of Wired magazine and author of a book called The Inevitable: Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. And he has a very different view on the notion of personal data.
I don't believe that we have personal data. I don't believe that we own data. I don't believe that data can be owned. I don't think I own my face. My face is something that's publicly outward facing, literally. And so any party that touches some information has a stake of both rights and responsibilities. And so the more connections it has, the more value it has, but those connections are all by different parties. And so I think we get really misguided by taking a kind of industrial age or even an agricultural age attitude about ownership of data, which I think you can't own data. Data is, by its nature, not really suited to the framework of ownership. And then I think it really misleads a lot of people when they think about, well, I own my data. No, data really can't be owned.
Kelly thinks that problems arise when there's asymmetry in our relationships with these big companies. He's happy to hand over information about himself as long as he gets some benefit in return, like when Netflix gives him personalized recommendations for what to watch, but not when companies take without giving back.
If there's information being accumulated about us, about a person, about me, about you, to make that symmetrical, first of all, I need to know everything about you. It has to be completely transparent. I need to know who you are, what you're doing with it, how you're storing it, how you're getting benefit from it. I need to be able to correct it if it's incorrect. I need to be able to have some say in it. And most importantly, I need to have direct benefit from it. Because if I'm not getting direct benefit from it, from me personally, then it's not symmetrical.
We asked Balkan whether he agreed that we should be seeking greater symmetry in our relationships with these companies that track our data.
Well, symmetry is an interesting concept, isn't it, when we're talking really about power relationships. Dear Google, I want to know everything about you. I want to be able to take a camcorder, walk into your corporate office. I want to be able to look at all of your paperwork, including your financials, all of your algorithms. I want to be able to see all of your source code. Let's do that as a beginning, and then we can start talking about symmetry, because right now, there is an exponential power differential between what Google knows about me and what I know about Google, or what the NSA knows about me and what I know about the NSA. Google, you know, makes these beautiful cameras that you can take into your house and they can, you know, watch what you're doing. But if you take a camera into Google today, you get arrested. So if we're talking about symmetries, great, let's talk about symmetries, but that will require Google and the NSA to be perfectly transparent in everything that they're doing. That's never going to happen. That's why privacy is an individual right. It's not a right for corporations. Corporations should be as transparent as possible. It's not a right for governments, democratic governments. Democratic governments should be as transparent as possible. To lessen that power differential, that's why we have privacy. Individuals have a right to privacy to protect themselves from far more powerful entities like multi-billion dollar corporations and governments.
You know, it's me, it's Mark, it's the, you know, Kevin Systrom at Instagram, it's all of these people.
In the face of this huge power differential, what can we do?
So part of what we're trying to do to achieve those goals is like take really big, audacious points of view on the world and then train ourselves to be patient. And it's really, really hard.
I had a school friend whose father sought to protect his privacy by refusing to use services that would require him to hand over information about himself. I don't think he even had a credit card. But it seems unreasonable to expect people to take that kind of approach. As Balkan says, it shouldn't be all or nothing.
You know, the trade-off that we should be faced with isn't should we not use social media, should we not use modern technology, or should we allow ourselves to be tracked and allow ourselves to have a lack of privacy in our lives. This is a false dichotomy. Because it assumes that there's only one way to build technologies, and that is this toxic Silicon Valley, centralized, proprietary, locked-in, closed, addiction-based, surveillance-based way of building technology. And that's simply not true.
And as Hussein points out, some of us really do need to use these services. We can't just log off and get on with our lives.
The challenge about requiring people to rise up in protest is that these companies have become so good at integrating themselves in our lives that it is impossible for the average middle-class individual to say, I'm no longer going to use LinkedIn because I protest over how they process my data. When LinkedIn is, for many people in professional classes, the way that you promote yourself in order to get a job. So the idea of a movement who will protest by walking away from our technologies, to put down our tools and never use them again, it's so impractical because these companies become so powerful and so necessary.
Another big story we're following tonight, the battle between Apple and the FBI. The tech giant says it's all about protecting your privacy, while the feds say it's all about national security.
And so the solution is to make demands of these companies and to use the full force of the law. And we are seeing so many positive movements on this front. In the past, say, 5 to 10 years, we've seen so many positive developments. The widespread use of encryption now on the internet is incredible. And it's not just because of hacks, but it's because of the expectations of users to be secure. The fact that almost every iPhone on the planet, of which there were millions, have such strong security on them that when the FBI in the United States wanted to have access, they had to ask Apple rather than just plug in the phone.
Inside this black Lexus, driven by San Bernardino attackers Syed Farouk and Tashfeen Malik, the FBI says it found a smartphone used by Farouk that could contain critical evidence. Did they plan more attacks?
There is so much positive movement on increasing security. But what we need to see more of is us being more demanding of companies, saying we're not happy not knowing. We're not happy being kept in the dark. And so the next time you get a price quotation for insurance, you should be demanding, how are you basing this? How is it you're charging me so much? I don't understand. And the next time we get an advertisement for a political party we don't like when we're on a website, we should be asking, how is it you're making this decision about me? How are you judging me? How dare you judge me in this way? The problem isn't that the algorithm is secret. The problem is the accumulation of all this data and things being done to that data without our knowledge. First, the accumulations without our knowledge, the processing is without our knowledge, and then we don't even know how it's being used against you. The processing itself can be problematic, and this is where you hear all these cases of, say, discrimination. And there's a very good reason why these things happen. We can't easily design it out. I'll give you the example of predictive policing. The idea of using algorithms to analyze policing data to then tell the police, actually, you know what? The temperature today is 7 degrees outside. In the past, when it's been this temperature, this part of town has tended to have this kind of criminality, so send the police there. Arguably, it's an efficient use of policing resources. The problem is, and this technology, without irony, has been developed in LA, where you have policing that's not historically known for being fair, is that it takes the existing policing data, which, let's admit it, the existing policing data in the United States, particularly, say, in LA County, is biased against certain races. And so this existing policing data says, well, look, all these black people and all these Latinos are going to be up to no good because that's what they were last year because we have this data. What the police don't have access to is all the data on, say, white middle-class criminals because they're not watching them in the same way. So the existing data isn't there. So when you apply the algorithms to the existing policing data, which says essentially, if you stop more black people on the street, you're going to find more criminality. The algorithm, which is not some piece of magic, says, you know what, tomorrow, do what you did yesterday, which is stop more black people. And so within a cycle of this algorithmic processing, you're just going to see more and more discriminatory policing. That's one of those aspects about artificial intelligence that we're not going to fix anytime soon. But what we do have to fix is the transparency around the data being accumulated. Why are they accumulating all this data? Who gave them permission to have all this data and then to process it even further? And do we have any insight on how it's being used against us or our neighbors or our colleagues?
If the data you feed it, you train it on, has biases, the system's going to pick up those biases, whether they're racial biases or whatnot, or socioeconomic biases. So that's very important that we understand that these are not objective systems. But more importantly, again, who owns and controls them? So this intelligence, who's gathering this intelligence? Is it a corporation? Is it you? If the machine learning algorithms are on your own devices and they're only accessible by you, there's no problem with that. That's you getting smarter about yourself. What's a problem is corporations using this with the vast amounts of data that they have to get ever increasingly smarter about you and then to exploit that relationship in their favor, whether that's for political gain or for profit gains. Because remember, these corporations are not politically neutral. They have needs. When I spoke with Eric Schmidt, he told me, you know, every day I wake up and I fight regulation. It's what I do. It's my job. So they are not apolitical. They have needs, lack of regulation being one of them, political needs. That's far more worrying for me. It's not the technology itself. As Melvin Kranzberg says, technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral. It's who owns and controls this technology. That's what will determine whether we live in a feudal system in the future or a democratic system.
What it comes down to, then, is regulation. We'll be looking at that in depth in our fourth episode in this series on the fight to wrest back control from the tech giants. In our next episode, we'll explore how the internet has warped our concept of trust, especially when that means trusting algorithms to make decisions that shape our lives. See you next time.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.